at verse 11. This chapter is divided into two main sections, 1 through 11 and then 12 to 32. It ends 33, 34, which is really an introduction into chapter 27. And so I was going to end this section and then introduce the next section, but I'm not going to try that. It's going to take a little bit more time than I would prefer. So we're continuing to study the generations of Isaac. And although we are in the midst of Isaac's life here, as we continue in this section of Genesis, we're going to learn that this is really more about Jacob than it is about Isaac, although this section is all about Isaac. You will notice that in chapter 26, there's no mention of Jacob and Esau until you get all the way down to 33 and 34 with the marriage of Esau to two Hittite women, and we'll get there when we get there. But as we look at Isaac going to Gerar, his intent is to go to Egypt to escape the famine that is in the land. And he is stopped on his way to Egypt by God, and he is told in this miraculous appearance to stay where he is in the midst of Philistine land, in the midst of where the land is suffering from famine. And while he is in the midst of this famine-stricken land, he has this theophany, this appearance from God, and God tells him in the beginning of verse 3, sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. This was a promise of God's presence. It was a promise of God's provision and of God's protection. God also said in the remaining part of verse 3, for to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. Remember, that oath is a solemn promise. When an individual makes an oath, it is calling upon God as a witness. And so when God makes the oath, it can't get any more solemn than that. And so God is calling upon the oath that he made to Isaac's father Abraham, saying, that oath that I made to Abraham, I am also making to you. Verse 4, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So the exact same promise God made to Abraham on several occasions that we studied in our previous exploration of Genesis, he is now promising to Isaac. One day in the future, Isaac's descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars of the sky. They are going to inherit the land that Isaac is going to sojourn in. Not only the promise of the land, descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. You could go out and just make a square anywhere in the sky doing this, and you could not count the stars. Too many. And that's going to be the number of descendants that Isaac and Abraham are going to have. Not just the land of Canaan, but all the land that Isaac can see off into the horizon. All the families of the earth will be blessed through Isaac, because it is through the line of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the line of the Messiah will be traced through. And because the line of the Messiah is traced through him, Jesus Christ is the one through whom all the nations of the earth will be blessed. The final thing that God says to Isaac in the previous section that we studied, verse 5, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. This is the expectation that is now being set before Isaac. Just as your father obeyed me, so must you. Now, if you remember our study of the life of Abraham, did Abraham obey God 100% of the time? Absolutely not. Did God recite to Isaac all of the errors, all of the failures in Abraham's life? Absolutely not. Yet Abraham is still declared to be a man of faith. It's important to remember, and we're going to review that when we get to the end of this section. So we'll see in our current study that Isaac will not be perfect, just as his father was not, but he will obey and he will be remembered as a man of faith. So upon the command of God to stay where he is in the land that is currently suffering from famine, as we learn from verse 6, Isaac responds and obeys God and stays and lives in the land of Gerar. Isaac no longer had to depend upon the stories told to him by his father. He's now hearing this most important promise for himself from God firsthand. The legacy of faith is being passed from the father to the son, to the next generation as God speaks personally to Isaac. Isaac is now positioned to become a great man of faith, but his faith at this point is unchallenged. And in the face of challenge, he will have a very simple choice to make. It's a very simple choice that he will make. It's a very simple choice that you and I are being asked to make. It is, we will either trust that God is with him or that God is not. That's the choice. What did God say? I will be with you. What has God said to us? I will be with you. In the testing of our faith, that is the choice we make. Is he with us or is he not? So we pick up the narrative here. And we're going to pick up in verse 7 and conclude at verse 11. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, "She is my sister." For he was afraid to say, "My wife," thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. It came about when he had been there for a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister?" And Isaac said to him, "Behold, I said, I might die on account of her." Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." After having the most significant experience in all of Isaac's life, this appearance from God, this theophany, Isaac should be on a spiritual mountaintop. Have you ever been there? Have you ever had such a significant spiritual experience that you felt like you could just accomplish anything that came your way? Now, Isaac didn't have Daniel in the lion's den to look at as an example, but what did he have? He had all the stories of Abraham's life. And Abraham had some amazing stories to tell him. Abraham would be able to say, "You know, my son, God put this in front of me and I failed, and yet God was faithful and did this. And the next time God put this in front of me and I trusted, and this is what God did." Abraham had many examples of testing of faith where he obeyed and God did amazing things in his life. So here Isaac has this amazing spiritual experience and he is ready to tackle whatever comes his way. And at this juncture in his life, when his faith is tested, he no longer has to depend upon just the stories that his father has told him. He has this own experience to now rely upon, to strengthen him, to deepen his understanding, to become an anchor for his own spiritual life, to deepen his resolve to live for God and to love God just as his father did. But we immediately see his humanity. We immediately see him resort back to himself And we see Isaac respond with the lie. The men of the place asked about his wife. They've seen the tent or the quarters that Isaac and Rebekah are living in, and they're milling around the place, and they ask about the woman, and he says, "She's my sister." He was afraid to say, "My wife." Why? Well, he thought the men of the place might kill him because Rebekah was very beautiful. Now, if you remember in our study of Abraham's life, the similarities are an exact parallel. Abraham was afraid. He told the exact same lie, and the rationale was the exact same. It was very simply self-preservation. That was at the top of Isaac's mind. If I tell the truth, certainly somebody's going to club me over the head and drag me off and bury me, and they're going to take my wife, and I'm going to be gone. He had no concern about Rebecca. He was only concerned about what was going to happen to me. That was it. It was all about self-preservation. As I mentioned last week, as a sideline here, there's no mention of Jacob or Esau. And many presume that chapter 26 predates what we've already looked at with the birth of Jacob and Esau and the selling of the birthright. And it is the reality that with no Jacob and Esau, the lie that Rebekah is his sister, it is what makes the lie believable. Now, we have no idea about how much time passed between the appearance of God, this theophany, and the telling of this lie, but what is apparent is this. Isaac has absolutely zero faith that God is with him. If Isaac really believed that God was with him, he would not have resorted to the lie. He has no confidence that God's presence is with him, and therefore God is going to protect him, and that God will provide for him and be faithful to carry out and complete the promises that he has made to him. What makes no sense is this. Isaac chose to trust God to stay in Gerar, this famine-stricken land, yet he is depending upon himself, his own wisdom, his own ideas, and securing what it is he thinks is what he thinks he needs. So on the one hand, I'm going to obey God and stay in this famine-stricken land, but on the other hand, I'm going to lie to protect myself from these people who I'm convinced are going to kill me. So I'm going to obey God, but I don't think God's going to be with me or that God is going to protect me. So while I'm going to obey, I'm going to depend upon myself to spare my own life. Does that make any sense? Does that not seem like a shock? Does that seem like, well, why in the world would Isaac do such a thing? He had this personal encounter with God, yet he chose to distrust God and instead place his faith in whom? In himself. I got an idea. I'm a pretty smart guy. I know what I'll do. I'll tell this brilliant lie. No one will be the wiser. And I'll just live out my life under the ruse of this lie, and everything is going to be great. You know, we do the same thing. Now, we don't have this personal appearance like Isaac had, but we do have the Holy Spirit of God that lives within us. We have the completed revelation of God that we hold within our hands, not only the little snippet of Abraham's life to look at like Isaac had, but we have the entirety of the Old Testament, and we have everything that Jesus did in his ministry and all that took place in the book of Acts and everything that Paul and the other apostles wrote and the rest of the New Testament. And yet we often choose to depend upon ourselves and not walk in faith by the power of the Holy Spirit. We often depend upon ourselves to secure what God has promised to us and our relationship with Him. God has promised His peace and His joy and the blessings that come from abiding in His presence, and yet we live our lives as if God has no ability to provide those things for us, and so we decide how we are going to secure those things for ourselves. As a reminder, Jesus said this in John 14, 27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful." Now, do we really believe that's true? Well, we believe it up here. But when push comes to shove, do we really allow it to be true in such a way that we rest in the abiding presence of Christ so that we don't devise our own plans in an effort to secure peace? How about this one, John 15, 10 and 11. "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be made full." So the prerequisite for our experience, the fullness of Christ's joy, is found in obeying his commands. Now, to his credit, Isaac stayed in Gerar, but Isaac did not abide in the presence of God and decided to trust in his own idea about telling a lie, and therefore forfeited the joy and the peace that would be his by resting in and trusting in the promised presence of God. In spite of what God had promised, Isaac chose to lie as his faith is being challenged. The people are milling about. They're asking these uncomfortable questions, and rather than placing his faith in the promise of God, he resorts to his own wisdom, his own insight. As I said last week, when the testing of our faith comes, we are often paralyzed by fear. Fear that is not submitted to the lordship of Christ and to the sovereignty of God will result in thoughts and feelings that are rooted in the flesh. Let me say that again. Fear that is not submitted to the lordship of Christ and the sovereignty of God will result in thoughts and feelings that are rooted in the flesh. This is too big for God. This is out of God's reach. God is too busy. God is too slow to act. Rooted in the flesh, the outcome will be carnal and will result in disobedience to God. We face circumstances in our lives that we don't like, right? Amen? We face consequences that don't end as quickly as we would like for them to end. Isn't that right? I can look back in my life and I have said, "God, how much longer will this last?" Have you ever said that? Have you ever felt that way? That's the testing of our faith. That's the challenge that we have in resting and abiding in the presence of God. And when we feel that way, it is when we must rest in the sovereignty of God, and we must place our fear at the foot of the cross and say, "Not me, but you. I submit it to you. You're in charge. You're in control. I can't do this. I can't fix this. I can't change this. And it is then and only then will we find the peace and the joy that God promises, because we will not resort in our own strength, in our own wisdom, in our own efforts to fix or change anything. And it is then that the result will not be disobedience, but it will be God's solution and God's timing for God's glory. So when you're facing the circumstance, God is in control. Do you really believe that? But when you wrest control from God, God, not you, me, I got to fix this, I got to do this, you're forfeiting the peace and the joy that God promises in His presence. Not in the eventual solution or outcome of the difficulty that you face, but in His presence. That is always the challenge in the difficulties that we face. It's resting. It's not striving. It's resting. Fear that is not submitted to the Lordship of Christ and the sovereignty of God will result in thoughts and feelings that are rooted in the flesh. I have to do this. God can't, won't do it in fast enough time. The outcome will be carnal and it will result in disobedience to God. Number five, the discovery. Isaac is told this blatant lie. And now we have this discovery in verse 8. It came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. So for a long time, Isaac and Rebekah were able to live out their lie amongst the people. There's no way to know how long, quote unquote, a long time was. But it's not a matter of days or weeks or months. My estimation is a few years, if not longer. They had grown very comfortable in their ability to live out their lie. Now, there's a very important lesson to learn there. We can often live out a lie and not be caught immediately, and we can think no one's ever going to learn. No one's ever going to figure it out. We got away with it. It slip through the cracks, right? Wrong. God always knows, and eventually somebody's going to find out. We don't think they will, but eventually they will. By chance, perhaps by providence, the king observes Isaac and Rebekah in some kind of physical activity that makes the lie of a brother and sister relationship incredibly obvious. My translation says caressing. I didn't look to see what the other translations say. In the Hebrew, it says Isaac and Rebekah were Isaacing. It's a play on words of laughing. What it means is they were doing something that brothers and sisters just don't do. It was very clear that this was a lie. Remember, there's no mention of Jacob or Esau here, which again affirms this likely predates their birth. There's a lot that's been made out of the king looking out a window and observing this physical activity, but there's no way to know exactly what this means. It is very likely that because Rebekah and Isaac have been able to live out this life comfortably for a long time, they're somewhere in public, perhaps somewhere around the king's palace or the king's house, and he just happens to see them and witnesses them doing something that brothers and sisters just don't do. This leads to number six, the confrontation. Verse 9, Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister?" And Isaac said to him, tail between his legs, "Because I said I might die on account of her." As we might say today, the jig is up. You've been caught. The lie is over. He's been called out before the king. Now, there's something here that we don't know about. There has to be some kind of a relationship here that the king would call Isaac and have this conversation here, but we really don't know the dynamics of the relationship. But for whatever reason, King Abimelech calls Isaac and says, "What is this thing that you have done?" So unlike the narrative related to Abraham, where Abimelech was told in a dream by God to leave Sarah alone when Abraham told the same lie when he was in the same land, here the king learns on his own that Rebekah is a married woman. Now, I mentioned this last time, Abimelech is the title for a king. This is not the same Abimelech that was king of the Philistines back when Abraham was in the land some 80 years earlier. It's kind of like Pharaoh over Egypt, King Abimelech over the Philistines. So Isaac is now forced to tell the truth, and his rationale, his explanation, is nothing short of an absolute insult to the king and to the people. Here's what he says in a paraphrase. "Well, king, I was quite certain that you or one of your people was going to kill me and take my wife for yourself. So I told the lie in order to save my own life." Well, I'm sure that's exactly what the king wanted to hear, right? Well, this leads us to number 7, and that is the rebuke. Verse 10, Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." Now, what may not be incredibly obvious as we read through this and not give a lot of thought to it is this. Here we have a pagan king, not a worshiper of Yahweh, who is confronting Isaac, the man who had just had this firsthand experience with God. Isaac, the man of promise. And this pagan king is holding Isaac accountable for this blatant lie that he has told. Notice the king's concern. "What have you done to us?" His concern is for his people. In his estimation, there was the potential for guilt to be brought upon the entirety of his country, because if Rebekah were to be violated because of Isaac's lie, his country would have had guilt brought upon them by Isaac's God. Abimelech may or may not have known something about Isaac's God, perhaps passed on by word of mouth because of Abraham's history and knowledge of Abraham's God, and what the people might still have known about Abraham's encounter with the previous king Abimelech. We don't really know. We would have to just assume or read between the lines. But the violation that might have come would have been completely unintentional, because they would not have known that Rebekah would have been a married woman, but the violation would still have occurred and the guilt would still have been placed upon his people. The king is incensed because his people would have been guilty for something that they would not have known they would have been held guilty for. This would have brought great shame upon potentially the king or upon his people. Isaac was only concerned with himself. He never really cared about Rebekah. He never thought about the king or about the people of Gerar. And he never, ever thought about God or about the promises that he made. Even though King Abimelech is not a follower of Yahweh, he displays more honor and more integrity than Isaac, the man of promise, displayed. That ought to shock Isaac to his very core. That should have been the most humiliating experience Isaac could have ever imagined, and it would have been, it should have been the very opposite of the mountaintop experience from this theophany that he had some time before. This appearance from God and this denial of everything that God had told him, much like Peter's experience in this encounter with Christ, promising to die with him, and yet a few hours later denying that he even knew who Jesus was. So in order to protect his people, the king lays down the line in verse 11. So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." So rather than Isaac's protection coming from God's presence, and rather than resting in God's promises appropriated through faith, Isaac's protection is coming from a pagan king who is simply concerned for the well-being of his people. There's a lesson to be learned here. When we display a lack of faith in God, and in Isaac's case, lying for self-preservation, when we display a lack of faith in God, someone in the lost world is going to notice. Your friends, your coworkers, your neighbors, perhaps even people in your own family, when we display a lack of faith in God, this failure of faith, people notice. It will bring shame to the name of God, and it will hinder our testimony. We can never, ever be guilty of saying, "Well, it's such a little thing." You know, that's a lie from the pit of hell, and that's what Satan would want us to believe so that we can continue to display these seemingly little lack of faith episodes in our lives so that they continue and they're really not a big deal. But make no mistake, the lost world notices. And if that becomes a continual deterrent for them to consider the claims of the gospel and the life-changing experience that we claim to have had with Jesus Christ, well, we ought to think twice about these little lies that we tell, these little lacks of faith that appear in our lives, because they're probably doing far more harm than we could even begin to imagine. In the book of Romans, Paul quoted from the Old Testament to chastise his fellow Jews. Here's what he says in Romans 2:22. "The name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written." Now, I don't know anybody who would want that to be said about them. The name of God is being blasphemed in the world because of you. God, would you want that to be said? It is. It's being said about all of us, myself included. Why? Because they know what we profess and they see how we live. And that is why when we fail, we must display the authenticity that says, "I am an incomplete work. I am in as much need as of the grace and mercy and the love of God as you are." Because I am still a sinner, even though I am saved by grace. But when we walk around with a self-righteous finger pointed at all the hellions out there, "You need to be more like me," we are doing a tremendous disservice to the name of Christ and to our testimony. Well, the bottom line here is this. Although Isaac likely heard his father repeat to him God's promise hundreds and hundreds of times, he heard how God was faithful to his father, and he saw how God had blessed his father. Now he has heard from God with his very own ears and he heard for himself these very same promises, and yet he has allowed his fear to overrule his faith instead of trusting that God was with him as he promised. Instead of trusting that God would protect him and that God would bless him, Isaac chose instead to take matters into his own hands. And this is a window into our own hearts. When our faith is tested, it's easy to forget that God has promised to be with us. It's easy to forget that he doesn't need our help in working things out for our good. We must choose to remember that the joy we desire and the peace that we crave can only be found in the abiding presence of the Holy Spirit within us. When our faith is tested, when the circumstances roll in, we must place our fears at the foot of the cross and thank God that he has won, already won the victory, and two, promise to never leave us or forsake us, and three, always, always work these things out for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. We must simply choose to find our rest in him. Now, I want to tell you, that is not the natural response. It is the spiritual response. And when the difficulties and the circumstances and the challenges come, our instinct is to do what comes naturally. And we must teach and train ourselves to do what comes spiritually by saying, not me, you. Not my way, your way. Not my strength, your strength. Surrendering it to him, determining to be as obedient as you know how to be, so that we can rest in his presence and find the strength, the joy, the peace that he has promised. Isn't that what we want? Then we have to get ourselves out of the way so that he can promise, so that he can fulfill what he has promised in each of our lives. Let's pray together.